I'm Gail Hunt, and I'm excited to bring you Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin, a rock and talk series of Cliff's Tales from the Road, a behind-the-scenes look at his rock and roll adventures right here at WCUW. And last week, we heard about something hitting the fan. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. I was referring to, we were making American Standard's second album down at Compass Point Studios in Nassau. The idea, just to reiterate from last week a little bit, the idea was to have us make our second album right away, not tour the first one, go right into the second one. So we started writing songs, and okay. The band was augmented, by the way, but with a gentleman named Paul LaRange, who was really a guitar hero of mine from back in the Newbury days. It's the American Standard, it's John Riley and Howie Hirsch, Derek Dyer, Kevin Falvey, myself, and Paul LaRange. And here we are down in Nassau, and we made the record. And something transpired with our manager and Chris Blackwell. Basically, I think he asked for too much more money or some type of deal. The logic would be, well, the Island's got too much money into us right now, so we can even get more. Ha ha ha, didn't work. Chris went, essentially, to paraphrase, Chris said, see ya. So that's what hit the fan. All of a sudden, we had two albums. One was out. The other one hadn't come out yet. We were done with Island. Howie and myself were lucky enough to stay with Joe, because at that time, Kevin wanted to keep the band going, and I didn't think that it was where I wanted to be. We just, Howie and I stayed with Joe, and Kevin did keep American Standard going for a while. He and John Riley and maybe Paul added some new guys and tried to keep going. But then I was pretty much with Joe really full time at that point, because there really wasn't an American Standard for me. And that's okay. I mean, I think at one point Kevin did ask me, you know, God bless him, he's not with us anymore. He said something to the effect of, well, why are you going to do this? I said, well, let me just turn the question around to you. I can be a side man for you or a side man for Joe Cocker. What would you do? That kind of question answered itself, you know, because Kevin was the main songwriter. He was the main singer. We all were in a band together, but, you know, in every band has guys that are the main guys, and he was, and rightfully so. I didn't see much of a future there for me, so we carry on from there. This now is 1979-80. The Luxury Can Afford came out on Elektra Asylum. Didn't really make a lot of noise. And so now Joe is a man without a record deal, but he could still play and tour, and that's what we did. I remember the beginning in 1980, the winter of 1980. My son Jeff was just born New Year's Eve on 79, and we hit the road like a week or two into January. We went to Alaska in January, and that subsequent June we went to the Southwest, New Mexico and Arizona and and Texas. Yeah, wacky. You don't want to. I'd never seen the ocean frozen in place. Yeah, we played Anchorage. For those of you who've never been there, it's an incredibly beautiful place, but it might as well be Saturn. You know, it's out there. It's wild, the wild, wild west, because this is 1982, you know, 1980, yeah, 79, 80. So it was not primitive, but certainly the wild, wild west. When you landed at Anchorage, you came down towards the baggage check, and there was this 8-foot stuffed grizzly bear at the base of the escalator, which really says it all. Great place, though. You know, a lot of spirit.
And you were on the road for 12 years with Joe.
But yeah, 76 to 88. That's 12, isn't it? I can do the math on that. You know, and again, he could tour. We in 80, we went to Europe, back to Europe for really the first time in a long time for Joe. The European market really embraced him. They never really were fed up with him. A lot of the promoters in America were, because he had kind of misbehaved a little bit. And what about promoters? You know, these guys are all about money. Mm-hmm. And nobody likes to lose money, or nobody's going to book an act that people perceive as a risk. That's essentially a lot of the promoters. Back then, keep in mind, it was before Live Nation. So you had your main promoters in each city. Like Boston was Don Law. New York City was Ron Delsner. San Francisco and out west was Bill Graham. And they had guys like that all throughout the country. You know, the guys in Texas, guys in Florida. So we played some interesting times in America around that time. It wasn't exactly what I'd say the lap of luxury. It was more, well, for example, when we were touring Texas, they'd rent equipment for us at every gig. So all we were moving with is our luggage and guitars. The office in Hollywood must have found some car rental agency that was previously made Fujiyama smog bags or something, because it wasn't Hertz and it wasn't Avis and it wasn't, you know, it was just a missing in action rental company. But we rented two Ford station wagons, and one was the people that didn't smoke and the other one was the people that did smoke. But the point of the story is we were moving so fast and so many miles between gigs that we barely had enough time for ourselves. We just get up, we'd play, go to bed, get up early in the morning, and then the next, and drive 400 miles to the next gig. Well, one of the cars, the one I was driving, had back then the battery in the engine compartment had a clamp that clamped the battery down. Well, this clamp was gone, so the battery had slid over, and the fan had chewed away a cell at the battery. So the car wouldn't start, but it would run, for those of you who understand the mechanics of it. It's the truth. But because we had no way to turn the car in, because there were no rental car offices for this rental car corporation, what we did was fill it up. It was there with Fords. And back in those days, you could take the key out, and it would still run. So you could actually lock the car with the car running. So after the gig, we'd fill it up and let it run all night, go in, sleep, wake up real early, go fill it up again and drive all day. I think we let it run. We let one of these cars run for like 5 or 6 days straight till we could actually figure out a way to get close to return it. Because we didn't even have time to, you know, no one had AAA or anything like that, you know, because you could be stuck for hours and hours and hours if the car couldn't start. Someone later on said, why don't you just have jumper cables for the other one? But of course, we were musicians. We didn't understand that concept. There's a way. It was easier just to let it run, right?
I can't believe it. For 6 days.
Yeah. Of course, the price of gas in Texas at that point was, you know, 2.3 cents a gallon or something stupid. That was an interesting sojourn, you know, interesting few weeks. I got very, very nervous at one point. I got the hiccups for about 10 days straight.
Oh, no. So do you have any like favorite gigs or favorite tours or stuff where, I don't know, just like what's, because you did so many gigs, like you must have some ones you stand out or?
That's a real good question. We had a lot of fun all the time. So, you know, I mean, we were lucky enough to play over the course of that time, Carnegie Hall, the Sydney Opera House, Royal Albert Hall.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good
Hammersmith Odeon. You know, a lot of cool places. Probably one of the favorite ones that I remember was a gig we did. We went to Israel. Went to Israel a couple of times, but one time we were in Israel, we played a place called Caesarea, which is up north on the way to really Beirut. They staged the concert in the ruins of an old Roman amphitheater. Wow. That's where they put on shows. So we're on this stage, if you will, and the people are sitting among the ruins, and behind us is the Mediterranean. Just breathtakingly beautiful and charming beyond, you know, beyond belief. But I remember looking back behind us going, whoa, it's a real cool area. I mean, you know, you talk to the locals and they would impart, you know, in the old days, Beirut was called the Paris of the Mediterranean, because it was so beautiful before the strife, you know. An amazing gig that was, yeah. I mean, most of it, the thing that stands out to me is funny stuff. We played an outdoor concert in Tokyo once in the middle of a typhoon. it's kind of counterintuitive, you know. But it's true, you know. It was a lull in the typhoon that they got the show in. They wouldn't cancel it because they couldn't, I guess. We were only there, you know, for so many days or whatever.
Speaking of promoters and money, you told the story off Mike one time about having us do the an intro to a song for like 12 minutes.
Oh, yeah. That it was in Detroit. You know, the road manager, Tommy Sullivan, he was great. Just an aside story about Tommy Sullivan. He's from Oklahoma, and he's a real nuts and bolts guy, really, you know, straightforward. And he came to pick me up once. He was in Boston, and we were leaving, and he wanted to come to get me in Worcester and to go back to Boston and drop the car off at Logan Airport. And he came over to the house, and he was spitting nickels. He was saying, "You people are crazy up here." I said, "What's wrong, Tom?" He goes, "Your freeways cost money, and they have these round things called squares." Because Newton Square, you get to my house, right? Yeah. You know, a rotary. It's round, called Newton Square, and I'm giving him directions. "What are you, crazy, you people?" It was a total, you know, disconnect. Yeah, Tommy would always say, "Don't start till I tell you to start." That until he got paid, we weren't supposed to start. Because every now and then, the promoter, you know, wherever you were working, could try to pull a fast one. And knew it. Once the show started, until the show started, we had the upper hand. Mm. Once the show started, the promoter had the upper hand, because you're not going to stop it. People were going crazy. So somebody came back that looked official and said, "Go ahead, start." And Mitch went out there, started playing the intro to "Feeling All Right." Back then, the song we started the set with. And all of a sudden, one of our crew comes running into the dressing room saying, "No, this is only Mitch had gotten out there and started playing the intro. Dunga, dun, dun, you know what I mean? Dunga, dunga, dunga. You know how the intro goes." And he stopped the rest of us. "I'll tell you when you can, all the rest of you can go out there." Well, Mitch did the beginning of "Feeling All Right" for about 7 or 8 minutes while Tommy was finishing getting paid. It was kind of funny. But that was in Detroit.
How'd the crowd take it? They just thought.
Well, you cannot imagine. It probably built some suspense, didn't it? Because keep in mind, this is Joe Cocker. You still had, even the hardcore fans were saying, "Is he going to be okay? Where is he? Why isn't he out here yet?" They weren't getting disruptive or mad. They were on the edge of their seats thinking, "What's going on?" Suspense. Anyways, that was a funny time. I remember one time we were playing, we did this show in Phoenix. It was a place called the Celebrity Theater, and it was in the round. But what happened was the stage moved very slowly. It turned really, really slowly. So we get on and we're playing, and about two songs into it, Joe comes over to me and he says, "Cliff, I'm really, really afraid something is wrong." And I said, "What, Joe?" And he said, "Every time I close my eyes to sing and I open them, I see someone different in front of me." And I said, "That's because the stage is moving. It's rotating. The stage is rotating." And he looks at me and he goes, "Oh, that's great."
You're tuned to WCUW 91.3 on the FM dial, online at WCUW.org. I'm Gail Hunt. This is The Drive, and you're tuned in for our weekly segment, Fun Time with Cliff Goodwin. And we're hearing some great stories from his life on the road with Joe Cocker. And here's some more.
For those of you at home who have never been to Highland Street, there's a shop there called the Modern Muse, owned by this lovely Greek girl named Maria. We were playing Athens. We're doing a ballad, nice quiet part of the ballad. Might have been "You Are So Beautiful." And all of a sudden, I hear someone scream, "Worcester!" It was her.
Oh, my God. Because
Maria would go to Greece every summer.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
and we were playing Athens, which in itself was an amazing gig, because visual dichotomy of a rock and roll show, kind of, and you look up and you see the Parthenon. You say
rock and roll.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You say to yourself, "Wow, this is how far we've come down." Me and Howie Hirsch continue on with Joe. It was an interesting time, a fun time, pun intended.
Oh.
You know, but Joe had no record deal. I think while we were down there. Oh, that's when I got hooked up with Robert Palmer for a minute. I was sleeping one morning, and this guy shaking me came into my room, and we rented a couple houses down in Nassau, and he's like looking at me, and he's going, "Robert, Robert, Robert," the thick Cockney accent, you know, and I'm going, what? What are you? Rupert, Rupert. It was probably like 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning, which was early for us back then. Of course, now, you know, I have a paper route at 6 o'clock. We determined this guy wanted me to come up to the studio because Robert wanted me to play on his album, Secrets. This guy was shaking me. Turned out to be this famous road manager for Traffic. His name was Dave Harper. But you couldn't understand a freaking word he said. You know what I mean?
Let's hear about that on the next episode.
Another cliffhanger. Yeah. We are the masters of suspense.
That's right. It's rock and roll.
I'd like to thank Cliff Goodwin for this fun time episode. We look forward to hearing more next week. Tune in to The Drive at 5 and for our Rock and Talk series around 6 p.m.